Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacy Toth of PaleoParents.com and author of two paleo cookbooks. The first, Eat Like Dinosaur, kid-friendly gluten-free recipe and guidebook, and Beyond Bacon, recipes that respect the whole hog.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne, also known as the Paleo Mom. I have a background in medical research, and I love to write approachable explanations of the whys behind the paleo diet. I'm also the author of two upcoming books, The Paleo Approach, which is a complete guide to managing autoimmune disease using diet and lifestyle, and the companion guide, The Paleo Approach Cookbook.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. So, welcome back to the Paleo View, everyone. What? I don't want to start so again. I always start so.
So. I was just going to say, so, long time no see.
Long time no chat. yesterday, as we were dropping you off at the airport, I was like, oh man, I got to talk to her again tomorrow.
I bet Stacy's so sick and tired of me now.
But, welcome back, dear old friend. You're in Georgia, and I'm back in the basement.
And it was 75 degrees and sunny here today.
It was really nice here today, too. It was 60.
Oh, well, that's good. I thought you said you were going to get snow.
I don't know. Russ was a paranoid, I guess.
He's just trying to get me to the airport early so you could get on the...
I think so. Russ was saying, Russ from The Domestic Man, we were hanging out with him this weekend, too, and he was like, supposed to be 6 to 9 inches worth of snow today. And then I looked at the weather forecast, and it was 57. Like, whatever. Russ.
Maybe he meant somewhere else in the country.
Yeah, maybe he went to Canada. I don't know. Anyway, before we talk more about hanging out and how our weekend extravaganza up the East Coast went, I do want to introduce this week's guest. I feel like we've had a never-ending supply of awesome guests on the show lately, and this week is absolutely, no doubt, one of those as well. I know Kelly from the Spunky Coconut from, like, my earliest of early paleo days. I remember that Kelly was using tapioca flour before it was ever cool in paleo. And in particular, I know that Kelly has a lot of egg-free recipes. And one of my friends, who was actually one of the people that I talked to a lot when I first went paleo, who was gluten-free and egg-free because her son had allergens, is like, oh, you've got to check out this blog. It's really awesome. And it was the Spunky Coconut blog. And Spunky Coconut and Alana's Pantry were the two sites that we used when we very, very, very early went paleo as, like, the family-friendly blogs in our own family's lives. And I remember just thinking, Kelly was the coolest. Your like thumbprint cookies were one of my kids' favorite cookies to make when we first went paleo. You probably don't feel this way, but like I feel really connected to you in a very personal way, just because I early on just really identified with you and your family, and we used you so much. And then, you know, we've developed a relationship with Alana when we did Eat Like Dinosaur because she did the forward to our book, and I felt like we talked more and became more friends. And
yeah.
You reviewed Eat Like Dinosaur, and each of your girls got a
copy.
Like,
the second I got it.
Yeah. And that was, like, a magical moment for me. So I'm super stoked. I've been on your podcast before, but I'm thrilled to have you on our podcast talking about a really personal topic, and we can't thank you enough for coming on this week and opening up and kind of sharing your family story with everyone. For those people that don't know, Kelly runs the blog. Is it thespunkycoconut.com or just Spunky?
Yes.
Yeah, thespunkycoconut.com.
They both work.
Which is a genius blog name, by the way.
Thank you.
And she has multiple cookbooks, but my favorite is her dairy-free ice cream cookbook, because hello, that's awesome. And one of the first paleo cookbooks to add gelatin to a bunch of food. I love that you can make ice cream and add gelatin to it. Genius.
Thank you.
And then, of course, she came out with, in 2013, the Paleo Chocolate Lovers Cookbook with stunning photography and beautiful design that reminded me of Beyond Bacon. I was like, how could I not love this book? It's like the chocolate version of Beyond Bacon. So anyway, everyone needs to check out Kelly. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It means so much to be here, and excited to talk and tell you a little bit about our story. I really appreciate it.
No problem. You want to kind of give people just a little bit of, like,
sure,
the teaser?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so, gosh, so hard to know when to begin. The blog started, The Spunky Coconut, I think in 2008. And it was just a way for me to share the real food, gluten-free, dairy-free recipes that we were making at home. And it really evolved over time as we took away grains. I did a grain-free book that came out, I think it was the same month that Rob Wolf's book came out, like whatever month that was. And I didn't even know what paleo was at that time, but we had been eating grain-free but not paleo that whole year leading up to Rob's and my book coming out. And so we were already going in that direction. And then I started finding out about paleo and trying doing more and more of that. So we took away quinoa and the legumes and buckwheat, which were the only things remaining in our diet, and started, like you said, the dairy-free ice cream, doing the paleo ice cream, and I did the paleo chocolate lovers. And kind of my signature is I use as little sweetener as possible in everything that I make, whether it's ice cream or cookies or cake. Although I will say, touching on that personal story that we're going to get into in a while, that my daughter, who's on the autism spectrum, really doesn't have a sweet tooth at all. And people are always asking me, you know, what about SCD and GAPS, and does she, you know, do better on those kind of diets? And for Ashley, she really doesn't eat a lot of baked things. I make cookies and I make cake, and it's really more of a treat for the rest of the family. So, I mean, she will occasionally have a treat. I'm not saying she never does. She likes ice cream. I'll give her that. She likes ice cream and for my frozen yogurt. But yeah, so we've been doing a second edition of the ice cream book with Victory Belt, our publisher that we share, you and I, and just handed that in, about to get the edits back. I'm really dreading the edits.
Yeah.
So fun. But I'm very excited to be doing a second edition of the ice cream with Victory Belt, because the chocolate book came out so beautiful, and I really felt like the ice cream book was not... It didn't look as pretty on the outside as it was on the inside, so to speak. So I'm excited. That'll be coming out this summer. And
good timing, yeah, for an ice cream book.
We just redid the blog, actually, gave it a facelift and tried to make it more user-friendly now we have thumbnails for the recipes for every category, tried to make it easier to use. And still, I think it's still like in the first 48 hours, so little buggy, but hopefully tomorrow all the bugs will be gone and it'll be running and beautiful, and I'm excited.
Congratulations. Awesome.
Thank you.
You trying to get in on that gelatin ice cream, Sarah?
I love gelatin and ice cream. Or even like sorbets or... Well, I just like gelatin. I'm actually drinking right now a cup of chamomile tea with gelatin in it. So
we use it every day.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Before we move on, Stacey, can we tell everybody how I flipped a 350-pound tire?
Three times.
No! Three times.
Wow.
So
I'd like to think that you had a very good coach that helped you through that.
You are totally the reason why I did it. I was actually looking at my phone because my youngest daughter wanted to see the video of me flipping the tire. And I looked at the first like three videos that were like short videos of that you took of me like getting it 4 inches off the ground and then not being able to get it any higher up and then dropping it and being like, what am I doing wrong? And Yeah, it was totally, you know, you coaching me through the technique and so that I was getting the right muscles to actually work to be able to lift it. But that was like such a feeling of accomplishment. It was really cool. For people who don't follow us on Instagram and saw the live, you know, as it was happening, Grams, can I call them Grams? Instas?
I guess.
Whatever.
I like Instas. Vids.
That works. Stacy took me to her gym, Nova Strength and Conditioning, Saturday morning before our book signing in Alexandria. And I, you know, I was basically my, like, I wanted to try a strongman workout and I wanted to kind of try some of the stuff that Stacy's been.
It was like the only thing that you asked to do in the area. And it was the only time we had either. And you're like, yeah, I don't want to explore DC. I want to go play with your strongman toys.
That is exactly what I said. And I stand by my choice because it was really fun. And I just had such a sense of accomplishment after flipping that tire three times and doing a 170-pound farmer's carry. I don't know, the Atlas. What was the weight of the Atlas stone I lifted? It was puny.
Yeah, it was like 30, I think.
It felt heavier than my kids. I don't know if it was just like because it was such an awkward size, but yeah.
You had also tired out at that point.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I had done a ton of
tires
stuff.
And stuff like that are going to wear your back muscles out. So then when you try to do stones, it's, you know.
Yeah. You know what? I went into it being like, if I can do like a fifth or a quarter of what Stacy can do, I will be so proud of myself. And then I was like flipping a 350-pound tire. It was awesome. So I really surprised myself actually with how strong I am. Like I didn't actually, I mean, I have been feeling like I've been getting stronger, like with doing more strength training workouts this year. But, that was a type of affirmation that I don't get from, you know, moving up from a 12-pound weight to a 15-pound weight in my classes are so like Metcon, like they're so cardio intensive and it's really, high rep, low weight. So, you know, change from 12 pounds to 15 pounds is enormous because you're doing like 60 reps of something. And to be able to do the complete opposite type of movement was pretty awesome. So, and plus the book signings were really fun too. It was a pretty great weekend.
Yes. And shout out to our buddy Russ, who hosted us on Saturday night. He and his wife Janie and their adorable son Oliver are like the most hospitable people ever. I love staying with them just because Janie is like Martha
awesome.
Stewart.
Awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they made a wonderful autoimmune friendly dinner for us and
out of a modification of a recipe out of the ancestral table too.
Definitely.
What recipe was it?
Rendang.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It was a curry dish that he modified by taking out the spice. He just didn't put in the spicy curry and the bell pepper and instead put in some pumpkin. And it turned out really good. And then he made like a couscous type of collie rice with some raisins in it that I really liked. And then he made a kind of autoimmune friendly. Was it? Yeah, because there were no eggs. There was no, I don't think there were any nuts or seeds in it either. He made like a flatbread kind of thing that Sarah and I could eat. And that's going to go up on his blog soon. So.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was like naan almost.
It was totally like naan.
Yeah.
It was perfect with the curry. So everybody, that's where it's at. The ancestral table, eat out of it. It's delicious. And then we went up to Philly with him, Philadelphia on Sunday morning and got to eat at a restaurant before the signing called Pure Fare. And if you're even like remotely on the East Coast, I would say it's worth a trip to like go for a weekend to Philadelphia. We had a ton of fun just walking around. It's an adorable city. And then make sure you eat at Pure Fare because they made homemade pecan milk in the store that morning and then made lattes with the pecan milk for us.
It was so good.
And they had grain-free cookies. They had coconut milk custard.
They had paleo cupcakes
yes.
or muffins. They were kind of unfrosted cupcakes. They were sort of...
There was like an olive oil cake made with thyme and fresh grapes that Sarah and I are both kind of obsessed with.
I literally was like, I have to figure out how to make this. This is so amazing.
Unbelievable to walk into a restaurant and be able to eat like 90% of the things. Like there was some quinoa, and Sarah and I can't have nightshade, so that's always like frustrating. But that's not fair to like complain to someone about, because that's totally paleo. Like tomatoes are paleo. But we were both able to eat there. We were both able to have treats, and then the pecan lattes were crazy. So, yeah, we had a great time. And to everyone who came out, both to the Alexandria book signing and the Philadelphia book signing, thank you. It was so nice to meet you guys. There was a very different crowd on both days. There were quite a few people who told Sarah and I that they listened to the podcast and they knew a few things and they followed us on Instagram and were afraid that they were stalkers. And just to be official on the record, you're not technically a stalker until you show up at our front door. Sarah,
and that is where I draw the line. Yeah. Front door showing up is, excuse me while I go get the phone and dial 91 something.
So, but everyone was wonderful, and it was, I honestly have been to, I was telling Sarah before the signings, quite a few joint book signings with a variety of people, and it's really interesting to me the different dynamic of, like, who shows up for what signings. Like, when we had Danielle here for Danielle's book signings, there was an unbelievable amount of people with digestive distress who were finding health through SCD and through paleo, and really credited Danielle to helping them be able to navigate social events and birthday parties, and seeing people cry and say, Danielle, you helped save my health, was, you know, like, amazing. And then there's a very similar type of crowd with Sarah's fan base in that they're all people with autoimmune diseases, some of them debilitating. And to see women so emotional and crying because they're just in her presence and so thankful for what she's doing was, well, I mean, it's amazing. So it was nice to witness that. And then Russ and I had the people who are like, you make yummy food. I do get a family crowd, which is also really heartwarming for me. There are quite a few people who brought well-loved copies of Eat Like a Dinosaur, and I love hearing that it helps children feel better about being different, which was the goal with that book. Mm. So it's really special. It reminds us why we do this, and it was also a really great opportunity to just hang out with friends. So thanks to everyone, Sarah and Russ included, for organizing that and letting me tag along, and it's a lot of fun.
No, Russ organized it all. I didn't do anything.
Russ didn't do anything either. Janie did it all.
Thank you. And, you know, I basically, Stacey very eloquently already said everything I was going to say, thanking everyone for coming out. So just so you know, thank you. I second that.
Ditto. Cool. So, Kelly, you're on the West Coast now, and I saw you did some signings. How did that go?
Yeah, we actually drove all the way from Southern California, where we are, up to Seattle and back in October. And it was an amazing experience being able to do a road trip like that with the kids and stay with friends and family and meet people at book signings. I forget how many book signings we did. I want to say there were about 6 or 7. I don't know. But it was incredible, and I'll never forget it. The girls will never forget. We have 3 girls, and they are 2, 9, and 11 years old. And actually, it's funny. The only one, you'll be surprised, the only one who was homesick and wanted to come home was the oldest. And I would have thought that, like, the baby, you know, was getting frustrated or tired of driving and staying with people, but it was actually my 11-year-old that wanted to go home. And on the way home, she asked Ginger, the 2-year-old, where she lived. And mind you, we had been gone for almost 4 weeks when she asked Ginger, where do you live? And Ginger, like, looks at her in the car and she goes, with friends? Like, with friends. We live with friends. That's where we live. But it was really cool.
There's nothing wrong with that being where you live, I think. Being surrounded by friends and family is pretty awesome.
Yeah, she was two. Yeah, she's two. She just, like, had been gone for so long, she didn't remember, like, before that. So it was amazing and such a cool thing to be able to meet readers and, you know, like you were saying, when they bring you your book and it's like falling apart because they use it so much. That was like a little heart jerking seeing books like falling apart and stuff. And there were a couple of people in Seattle, I think. It was maybe Portland too, but definitely in Seattle, who were in their early 20s. And they had gotten my first book and started following the blog, you know, back in 2008 when they were pretty young, like teenagers, but, you know, maybe 15, 16, something like that, and had the original copies and said how they had to take them with them when they moved out. And it was, I just had never thought that that was possible. Like it never occurred to me that there could be such young people that have known me for that long and been reading my blog for that long. And that was really cool. I mean, it was all cool, but, you know, seeing the younger people like that surprised me, and it was neat.
Very cool. Well, I've known you for almost 4 years at this point, so I mean, I was young then. I'm only 22 now. All right. Well, have we caught up enough? Because I feel like Kelly came on very generously to talk about a topic that we have received so many questions on. And Sarah mentioned before we got on the podcast that this has been a topic that was on our list of things to cover before we even started broadcasting the podcast, when we had like our initial outline of what we wanted to cover. And I think for both of us, we felt like not having the firsthand experience, it's difficult to claim to be able to answer these questions. So I am really looking forward to hearing both from the science perspective what Sarah's found on nutrition helping or not helping the autistic spectrum, and Kelly's firsthand experience of how she has spent the last 9 years of her life or so figuring out how she can help her daughter and her family heal through food as well, which I think is really powerful. So unless you guys have other things to talk about before we get started, I'm looking forward to listening to you, because I don't have much to add. So
you say that now, Stacey, but I
know I can't ever.
There will
be
at least one soapbox from you
for sure. I can't do anything without a soapbox.
I'm pretty sure, you know, the listeners keep coming back, so I'm pretty sure people are okay with that. And I hear we're up to like 28 like male listeners now.
Yeah, we got one through Twitter like a week or two ago.
I think it's like 28.
Nice. I'm going to start making the kids listen, and that'll put us over the 30 mark.
Woohoo!
I love that you have three boys and I have three girls.
Yes. Hey, you know what? Gwen Stefani had her third boy like this month or last month, and I mean now it's official. That's what the cool people do. They have three boys.
I just have nothing to add to that.
Sidebar, because that's what happens on the podcast. We went to a little like shop in Philadelphia where they had like a variety of really awesome, like artsy kind of children's things, and I walked by because there were some really awesome superhero t-shirts in the window, and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to get shirts for
it. Was the Batman ugly doll, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, the Batman ugly doll kind of sealed the deal. But the t-shirt, like, I wanted to get t-shirts for the boys, and I went in, and, you know, I'm shopping and I spend like an insane amount of money on these like boyish boy superhero kind of things. And it took me so long that Sarah, who had no intention of buying anything, finds these two like pink and purple with glitter shirts, and we're both in the checkout and Sarah's like, I win, and I'm like, no, I win. Very different children for sure.
Yeah, and so this is another total aside. So I got home quite late last night and the kids were already in bed. So I got up this morning and it was quite painful. I was still mostly asleep to like make the kids' lunches and get them off to school. And my oldest daughter comes down from upstairs and apparently nobody brushed her hair all weekend.
Oh my gosh.
And she had swimming both Saturday and Sunday.
Oh.
And it was like tears. I mean, she was just bawling her eyes out while I tried so hard to be gentle to get out all the matted tangles. And all I could think of was, I bet Stacy doesn't have this problem.
Exactly.
I do with Finn, but we kind of brush his hair only like once a month. It's like, once it gets really bad, then we're like, all right, buddy, it's time. And he's like, no. But he's the only one with hair that we have to brush, yeah.
Well, Ginger has practically no hair, so.
Both of my kids were sort of bald kids until about two.
Yeah.
And then they started to get hair.
My
oldest, her hair just gets tangled so easily. And, you know, I've got all these great natural conditioners to put in it. And as long as I'm proactive with that, it's okay. But she also likes having long hair because she does ballet and she wants it up in a bun. And my youngest, I never wash it. I never brush it. It always looks great. I don't like, it's the most like low maintenance hair ever. And it's complete opposite.
Yeah.
That was a total aside.
All right. Who's ready for some science?
Me.
Me too. Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys. So, because the theme of today's show is autistic spectrum disorder, there was actually two sort of smaller topics that I wanted to touch on about ASD and Science with Sarah. And the first was one of the like really commonly asked questions that I get, and is that whether or not ASD is an autoimmune disease. And the answer to that question is there is some intriguing research that shows that there may be a link. But at the moment, we don't actually know if there is an immune system targeting tissues in the body aspect to ASD. I mean, clearly there's an inflammatory aspect, but whether it's really an autoimmune disease where the immune system is forming antibodies that recognize, you know, some kind of protein in the human body and that's targeting an attack and that's responsible. At this point, we don't know. But what's really interesting about ASD is that there is a really strong association between kids with ASD and a mother who has celiac disease or rheumatoid arthritis. And there's a really strong link between ASD and any family history of type 1 diabetes, whether mother or father. And this is sort of the research that's why some people are starting to think that there may be a link between ASD and autoimmune disease, because often autoimmune diseases run in families. There's a genetic predisposition. And because the part of what autoimmune disease you have is like exactly what antibody is formed, and chance is such a huge part of that initial process in the development of autoimmune disease. That's why you'll see autoimmune disease running in families, but different members of the family will have different autoimmune diseases. And so that association between celiac disease and rheumatoid arthritis is why people are thinking there may be some kind of link that autistic spectrum disorder may be autoimmune. It may also be that there's some genetic that are related. And
don't you think it's environmentally triggered, Sarah? Because if you look, it didn't exist before the 80s.
I think that it's very, very likely that the same things that cause, you know, it's when you look at chronic disease, just in general, I mean, not just autoimmune disease, but chronic disease in general, there is such a close link between diet, the nutrient density of the diet. Look, it's not just the stuff that's in it. It's not just high fructose corn syrup and gluten-enriched breads and, people are eating more fast food and getting more omega-6 fatty acids. It's not just so much that that has become such a huge part of the human diet. It's that that has replaced nutrient-dense food. And the fact is that the vast majority of people are deficient in almost all vitamins and minerals. And you need vitamins and minerals for your immune system to function normally, which is why if you don't have them, you get inflammation, and inflammation is a part of all chronic diseases. And you need it for brain health. You need it for neural health. I mean,
and the methylation cycle.
And the methylation cycle. And that was, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm actually going to mention this. I'm going to pass it to you, because one of the, it's not necessarily a risk factor. It's seen very commonly in autoimmune disease is defects in the methylation cycle. And we actually talked about that a little bit when Terry Walls was on the show a few weeks ago. We talked a little bit about MTHFR, and we talked, I mean, we were talking more about how to support mutations in MTHFR that might reduce activity, like the C667T mutation. But that may be the common link, the common genetic susceptibility between autoimmune disease and ASD. And that's just, you know, a hypothesis. Nobody's actually looked at that yet. But Kelly, let me pass it on to you, and you can maybe talk a little bit about why methylation or a defect in methylation might be linked to ASD, because I think you know more about that than I do.
Well, I have personal experience with that. So when Ashley was not even two, she had a multitude of severe autism symptoms, such as flapping, you know, that's where they wave their hands up and down like a bird, screaming, just screaming isn't even the right word. It was a screech. And it was just all day. And she would look at the walls as if she was seeing monsters, like spiders climbing up and down the walls. Like she was terrified. She had severe sensory processing disorder. She couldn't touch anything, including food or toys, for 2 years. She was a headbanger. She banged her head on the floor, on the wall, often while screeching. What else? She did stimming, so stimulating repetitive behavior. She would sit in the kitchen on the floor and just open and close the drawer that was at her level, like literally for hours. I mean, I could go on and on. She didn't have language. She didn't respond when you talked to her. I mean, it was bad. And the minute we put her on a gluten-free, casein-free diet, most of those symptoms vanished like overnight. It was insane. And we took her to a doctor in Pennsylvania because there was still a lot of work to be done. She still wasn't, you know, still didn't have the language piece. She stopped screaming and flapping and a lot of that, but she was still very delayed and still needed help. So we went to this doctor in Pennsylvania who did a blood test, and we didn't know for years what it was even called. We had totally forgotten because there were so many tests that would go on from that point on. But she tested her for MTHFR. And I remember sitting in her office, and she said that they thought they had found what could be like the genetic predisposition with kids with autism, and how it was this mutated enzyme that would show that Ashley couldn't properly detoxify. So, you know, we're all supposed to be making glutathione, which is our body's natural toxin eliminator. And we're supposed to all be, you know, toxins in, toxins out, like every week, right? Well, she said that if Ashley had this mutation, that she would have a very hard time detoxifying. And so everything would just build, and she would have this toxic burden, this load. And sure enough, she has one of the two mutations that go with MTHFR. And so from that point on, that was almost, gosh, almost nine years ago. She'll be 10 this summer. We have been struggling since then to help her detoxify. And she was so young, you know, like I said, she wasn't even two when she had that blood test. At that time, for a couple of years, we really focused on just nutrient-dense foods, and we did some other tests to see, like, exactly what fatty acids that she needed. She had a fatty acid test, and so we worked on that to, you know, give her exactly what she was missing. And when she was four, she was able to label. And labeling, for people who aren't really familiar with autism, is when a child will, you know, name things, car, boat, you know, they can kind of label what things are. She could do that. And she could do what they call echoing, or echolalia, I think it's called. And that's when I would ask her a question and she would repeat the last word that I said. So I would say, do you want to eat? And she would say, eat. And I would say, do you want to go? And she'd say, go. So that at 4 years old, those were her only two forms of speech, were labeling and echoing. So we did a porphyrin test with our doctor. And at that point, we had moved from the East Coast to outside of Boulder, Colorado. And so we had a different doctor. And I remember she got the porphyrin test back, which looks to see if Ashley was holding heavy metals. And she was holding so much lead and mercury that her doctor in Boulder said, I don't even understand how she can speak at all.
Wow.
She said that she had kids with less mercury and lead that were totally nonverbal. And I can only assume that it was because of the nutrition that we had been doing, all the diet and, you know, very specific things based on her blood work and urine work that we had been doing that was giving her a little bit of an added benefit, you know, I don't know. But it was still very frightening to see all that heavy metal poisoning that she had. So we did our first round of DMSA, which is a prescription chelation, which is very common in the autism community. And we wanted to do it as gently as we possibly could. We were very cautious. I think we did a cream, so it was transdermal. It bypassed her GI tract. You know, we would rub it on her back. And I think it was 2 or 3 days a month. That's it, the cream. And we did that for 3 months. So a total of maybe 12 applications of the cream in a 3 month period. And at the end of that 3 month period, the last night that I put the cream on her back, I'm not making this up, I did a post about it on my blog the next day when it happened. She literally woke up talking the next day.
Wow.
Literally. It was mind blowing. And I was like writing it down. I felt like I was in a dream. You know, it was like, is this really happening? Am I imagining it? And I was like writing down what she was saying, and it wasn't anything special. It was just as if someone had turned on her ability to talk, you know, and she just could do it. So she was, and, it was amazing. So we had pulled out, they called that her first dump. So she had dumped her first amount of that toxic burden that she holds. And that's the important thing to remember with, like, Ashley, is that she's holding it. You know, it's, she could be, you know, you and I could be exposed to the same toxins as her, but if we don't have the mutation, if we're making a lot of glutathione, hopefully we're excreting it, you know, through sweat, through urine, through everything, you know, our hair, whereas Ashley isn't. So then from that point on, we tried just supplementing with glutathione, because we didn't want to have to keep constantly doing DMSA. The thing about DMSA is, even though I will give it credit, you know, it really helped that first round that we did, it doesn't know the difference between good and bad. So even though it was pulling out those heavy metals, it was also pulling out vitamins and minerals. And, you know, I'd rather not do that, obviously. If it's possible, it's better not to pull out all the vitamins and minerals. So we started giving her glutathione and didn't get a response. So we tried the, I think it was about 6 months later, we tried the DMSA again. And this time she actually regressed. So she, after, you know, 3 days of cream, she kind of stopped talking and freaked us out. And it was terrifying. And of course, we stopped the treatment. You know, our doctor was like, stop, stop, stop. And I doubled her supplements because we were giving her supplements to help with the DMSA, pulling out all that vitamins and minerals. And I think over the course of a week, she came back. You know, she gained all the progress. All the progress came back and all the speech came back. But it was totally terrifying. So at that point, we switched to something called OSR, which is no longer available. And that went well. We did that for a while. But what's really fascinating, and maybe Sarah can explain this to me, I still don't know why, ever since Ashley went grain-free, since she went totally paleo, because, you know, she's been gluten-free from day one, since she first had the symptoms of autism, and we went on the diet, she's been gluten-free and dairy-free. But when I took away the grains, because she was getting some rice now and then, some, you know, I don't know, I don't even know, mainly pasta, like rice pasta or actually rice, cooked rice. When I took those out of her diet a couple of years ago, she's now responding to glutathione in a way that she never responded before. And so I'm thinking that we don't need anything more hardcore, you know, that we're not going to, hopefully, we won't have to go back to something like DMSA, which, you know, I obviously don't want to do after she had a bad experience with it. But it's been really amazing. I tried, since we've been in California, I tried giving her, I think it was like a half a teaspoon, and that was too much. And in before, you know, when she was eating grains, half a teaspoon did nothing at all. And now I'm actually seeing her detoxing and she's having this experience with it. So it's great. I mean, I'm very happy to give her something natural and that her body can really do what it's supposed to do without, you know, being bombarded by things that I'd rather not give her.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I don't know that I have like a really definitive answer for why removing the non-gluten containing grains would make her respond more to glutathione supplementation. Yeah. Definitely there's proteins in common among all grains,
right,
that have very similar effects on the body. I mean, we understand gluten the best, I think, in part, we've done a lot of studies because of celiac disease, but also because it has the most dramatic effect on the human body. So it's always easier to study something that has a dramatic effect compared to something that has a less dramatic effect. And you can imagine, you know, this is clearly the case with people with autoimmune disease, but we seem to be more sensitive to the sort of weaker versions of those proteins. So like the other prolamines is the class that gluten's a part of in other grains. And we know in celiac disease that that's sort of our, like, you know, canary in the coal mine type autoimmune disease for studying these types of proteins, because as you know, a person with celiac disease is so sensitive to mm-hmm. gluten and related proteins. And we know that,
and I'm celiac,
and you're, well, there you go.
Yeah.
So we know that the proteins in quinoa, which isn't even a grain, it's a pseudograin, mm-hmm. And corn and buckwheat have all been shown to have a really, really high percentage of celiacs have problems with, mm-hmm. and even rice. Mm-hmm. And it's just because of the similarity between those proteins and the similarity in how the body responds to them.
Well, I have to give credit to my friend Shirley at Gluten Free Easily. After we went grain free and then paleo became what it is, and we started going more paleo, she sent me a message and she said, "Kelly, you know, how often is Ashley having rice?" Because she knew that was like the one thing that I was still occasionally giving them, rice or rice pasta. And I was like, "Well, it's not much. It's no big deal. It's, you know, maybe twice a week." And she was like, "I think that you should stop." And I was like, "No, no, no. It's only once or twice a week." And she goes, "I want you to stop." So thank you, Shirley. I honestly didn't think it was a problem. And I remember actually the day, it was shortly after she was pressuring me, I had made like a chicken noodle soup with rice noodles. And after we had lunch, we sat down, or Ashley sat down, I should say, and she just checked out. We didn't have TV. She just sat down on the couch, stared at the wall, and didn't look up again for like an hour. And I was like, "Whoa, what just happened?"
Yeah. And hey, maybe I should pay attention to this.
So I was like, "Oh, okay, Shirley. All right." You know,
well, and so also in cases where people are actually forming antibodies against gluten, we know that there's a lot of, you know, they're called cross reactors. So these proteins are similar enough in other grains and even other completely unrelated to grain foods like dairy, that the proteins are similar enough that if the body's reacting to gluten, it will see other proteins that are in the diet as exact same thing. And rice is one of them. So that's another possibility that, and it's basically, you know, I'm thinking that maybe her body was responding more to the glutathione simply because the burden to her gut health and the burden to her immune system were lower.
Yeah.
And so you could actually, you weren't sort of swamping everything out because there was so much inflammation. I mean, that's my educated guess.
Yeah, like less, it makes sense, like less work for her body. It freed up that all of that was, someone had mentioned to me that maybe her liver was freed up to do more with the glutathione because she wasn't eating those, you know, types of protein.
The liver has to work really hard when you're inflamed. And so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Something that you mentioned was actually a really good segue into the other topic that I wanted to talk about for Science with Sarah today, which was the gluten-free, casein-free diet where you started, because the scientific research has really shown diversity of responses of autistic children to gluten-free, casein-free diets. And some studies show tremendous effects. Some studies show no effects. And some studies show that there's responders and non-responders. And that's sort of the current consensus right now, is that there's responders and non-responders. And the current hypothesis is that autistic spectrum disorder, and the reason why it's called spectrum disorder, it is in part because there's this idea that it may have multiple causes.
Oh, yeah.
And there's, you know, there is a definitely variability in terms of presentation, symptoms, severity. And the thought is maybe it's actually a class of different diseases, and that, you know, one version of it responds really, really well to gluten-free, casein-free, and another version, you know, maybe something else is
yeast, candida.
And so there's that concept. But the other thing that I suspect, the way these studies are designed, is parents are given a list of foods to avoid. So they're given the list of what things contain gluten, what things contain casein, and then they're sent off to go figure out what to eat. And some people will take that list and go, "Okay, so I can't have any wheat and I can't have any dairy, so I'm going to have the boxed almond milk with all of the crazy emulsifiers in it, and I'm going to have gluten-free bread." And other people will take that list and go, "Okay, so, you know, we can't have, you know, pasta anymore, and we can't have bread anymore, so let's eat more vegetables. I guess we're going to have eggs for breakfast because we can't have cereal. All right, eggs and sausage and fruit for breakfast." And so mm-hmm. I think that there's a huge variability in how people implement a gluten-free, casein-free diet and how nutrient-dense that diet ends up being.
Yeah.
And you can take out – I mean, gluten is not a nutrient. And the foods that contain gluten tend to be very nutritionally poor. So when you remove gluten, you can replace it with other nutritionally poor foods. Right. other grains that are also high in manganese, because there's also this thought that manganese toxicity may be a part of ASD. And there's this other way that you can do it where you're replacing those foods with vitamin, mineral, and antioxidant-rich, you know, foods, and you're actually increasing your nutrient density. So you're actually giving your body more of the things that it needs for your immune system to function normally, for your neurons to be plastic. So it means that they're communicating really well with each other.
And again, the methylation, you know, the more nutrients, the better the methylation,
especially B vitamins, which are so important and richly found in things like green vegetables. So if you're replacing, that grain side dish with an extra vegetable side dish, you're getting a lot more nutrition and getting a lot more really relevant nutrition. So, I mean, I don't think, you know, that's something that really hasn't been studied, but I suspect that is the bigger contributor to responders and non-responders than necessarily the details of the, you know, the details of the disease. And I think you've had just a tremendous experience showing just how vital nutrient density was for Ashley's health. So I think that's, I mean, it's anecdotal, N equals one.
That's a great point. It's such a great point. Yeah, definitely.
So, Stacey, are you awake?
I am awake, and I am so very interested to discuss more on this. No, I really am. I think that it's incredible, like the science and the nutrition and the healing body, and this is the kind of thing that validates for me that, you know, my child going off of asthma medication wasn't just like a coincidence. He didn't happen to outgrow it at that time. You know, like it's really powerful. So I'm curious. I know, Sarah, we've got a ton of questions on these, and I think you pulled together a couple of representative questions that we'll try to tackle that maybe Kelly can help answer and make other people feel better about the choices that they're making or, you know, those sort of things.
Definitely.
All right, so let's do some questions.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Edson. And Edson writes, we have a 10-year-old son who has been diagnosed with ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder. Do you think any of the really restrictive diets like GAPS, FODMAP, SCD, or AIP would be a good starting point for him? And if so, which one? He's very receptive to trying this. Hmm. Kelly, do you have an opinion? AIP is autoimmune protocol. FODMAP is... are you familiar with low FODMAP diets?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just from personal experience, you know, as I mentioned, so many of Ashley's severe symptoms of autism went away with the gluten-free and then grain-free and casein-free diet. So that was just, I really think that the key to her success has been, as Sarah was talking about, such nutrient dense foods. You know, she really mostly eats protein, vegetables, some fruit. Ashley does fine with nuts and seeds. She doesn't eat a ton of them, but she does very well with them. And, you know, everyone is so different. I mean, I would really say, see what's working best. You know, if you think that there's a problem with, you know, certain thing, like a certain nut or a certain seed, then obviously, you know, stay away from it. But for Ashley, just real food and nutrient dense food and meat and protein and eggs and, vegetables, you know, it's just been the key to her success.
I think that would be my general recommendation as well, would be to start with what I'm starting to think of as like nutrient dense paleo. And it's one of the stepping stones that I often recommend for people who are coming into a paleo diet with autoimmune disease. And they're trying to think of, you know, like they're looking at the autoimmune protocol and it seems like just really hard. And, you know, I always think you try and see what kind of mileage you get out of standard paleo first. But one of the things that can be really, really helpful is that focus on nutrient density because of, you know, the B vitamins that are so important for methylation, but also because of how important long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, DHA and EPA from seafood and sea vegetables, just how important that is for neural health.
I think coconut's also been awesome for Ashley.
Well, yeah, so then you get the really easily modified, so the medium chain triglycerides
yeah.
in coconut are super easily modified into ketone bodies, which the brain can use for energy in the absence of glucose. And so if you have anything going sort of wrong with glucose metabolism, it's been shown to be really, really beneficial in people with dementia, because dementia is basically, well, at least Alzheimer's is. I don't know if it's generalizable to other forms of dementia, but it's basically considered like type 3 diabetes. Like it's a diabetes of the brain. And mm-hmm. so the brain's just not receptive to sugar. And so when you give the brain these ketone bodies, the brain can actually function better. So there's a lot of, you know, still mostly anecdotal evidence showing that supplementing with coconut oil or MCT oil can be really helpful with dementia. And I would assume that there's some commonalities in terms of, you know, what might be missing in the brain between something like autistic spectrum disorder and dementia. So that makes a lot of sense to me that coconut would be mm-hmm. like really a really healthful food. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's helpful.
Plus it's antibacterial and antiviral
and really high in vitamin E and mm-hmm. yummy.
You guys maybe want to go eat some coconut.
And so, I mean, that would generally be my first stop. It would be, mm-hmm. you know, get rid of the main offenders, which a paleo diet does, and focus on nutrient density. And you, our listeners know how much I like organ meat. Stacey, what are you going to say right now?
Kidneys and liver?
No, you're supposed to say bone broth.
Oh, well, yeah, that's mine. You said I like kidneys and liver. Yes, of course.
No.
Oh my gosh.
Your turn.
I totally forgot to talk about gelatin.
No, we talked about gelatin.
No, I forgot. Me, Kelly.
Oh. Bone broth heals. That's soup of Stacey. #, gelatin.
Like
rocks.
I couldn't get enough bone broth in Ashley because, you know, she's 9. So we started also giving her Great Lakes gelatin like every day in her smoothies and shakes and tea, like everything. And it has just been amazing for her digestion and like hallelujah gelatin. I can't say enough.
I like gelatin. I eat a lot of gelatin and a lot yeah. of broth, actually. I do both. I put actually the Great Lakes collagen into my tea. And it's, which is basically the same thing, except that it's hydrolyzed. So
that's what we use. Yeah.
Okay. So the protein's broken apart, so it dissolves a little bit more
green.
Easily.
The green label.
One. Yeah. We will put a link in the show notes, everybody.
Oh.
I love it. And not only that, like I use it as a whitener in my tea instead of coconut milk or something like that. And I love the flavor. I don't know what it is. Like, I think my body just craves it. Mm. But I gave my mom, I left a case when I was visiting my mom last summer, and my mom was like, when it ran out, she was like, I can't get that here. Can you send me more?
Oh.
I was like, yeah, mom, I'll hook you up.
Ashley loves her tea blended with in like a blender that has a vent, you know, like a Vitamix or a Blendtec. I blend her tea with a spoonful of coconut oil and my gelatin, my Green Label gelatin, and she adores it.
That's one of my favorite ways to have tea.
The best.
Ashley and I have something in common.
Yeah. She likes the dandelions, her favorite, because it's sort of coffee-like.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm drinking black tea. You don't want to give her black tea because she's 9.
No.
Yeah, but other than that, small detail.
But there's lots of teas that are great for kids, you know. Herbal. She likes mint. It's really yummy with mint tea.
My boys love well, Cole loves mint tea too, but you can buy like fruity flavored tea.
Oh yeah.
Loose tea, like pineapple and blueberry tea. And then I feel like they're getting the antioxidants of the blueberries and it's win-win.
And Ashley loves spicy food. She loves ginger. And I make like a lemon ginger tea. She loves that.
That sounds yummy.
It is.
I think I might make myself some of that when this podcast's over.
I mean, you can buy it or you can just use, you know, fresh ginger.
Lemon.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah.
Maybe throw in a little raw honey.
Yeah.
My favorite kombucha to make is lemon ginger kombucha at home.
Oh, she loves that.
That's what I make at home.
Well, that's because we are one mind, as we learned this weekend, my friend.
Clearly. And also bad influences on each other.
Oh my gosh, let's not talk about that.
All right, so moving on.
Did you guys
right
get matching tattoos?
That would have been a smarter choice.
What happened?
We just, we're old ladies, and we shouldn't be staying up late and eating gluten-free baked goods. Like, it's just not a good choice.
And two of us old ladies may be trying to recover today.
Got it.
Yeah. So let's do this question from Julie. Julie has twin daughters, both with autism, and they were diagnosed at 22 months. And so she tried to go gluten-free, and things just got stressful and they just fell off the wagon, like the whole family. And so she's been reading more about it and she wants to go gluten-free, casein-free as sort of a stepping stone towards full-on paleo now that she's reading more of the science.
I think she should get the three-phase paleo.
I just gave you a long-distance hug, Kelly. Because Sarah was talking about nutrient-dense paleo, and I'm like, you mean phase three? And you're like, now, they're doing a gluten-free, casein-free, and I'm like, oh, you mean phase one. Okay.
That's so, what I recommend.
So that's pretty awesome. Do you have – so her question goes on to basically say, you know, she's really concerned about the work of removing dairy. She's pretty sure that her girls are not tolerating dairy.
Yeah.
And so they both have eczema. One has what looks like keratosis pilaris. But dairy is like a huge part of their diets. And
I have a suggestion.
Sure.
I have such yummy dairy-free recipes on the Spunky Coconut. I think that's probably some of my most popular recipes are like my yogurt. I have a few dairy-free, few different flavors of dairy-free yogurt. You can make a yummy yogurt drink. You can turn it into frozen yogurt if your kids aren't a fan of, you know, just straight yogurt. You can blend it. I also have dairy-free cheese, like soft cheese, like cream cheese. I have a cheese ball that you can flavor if your kids like, you know, the kind of spreadable cheeses. So that's, if I may toot my own horn.
Please. That's why you're here.
I think that would help, right?
That would definitely help. And now, Stacey and I might go on a soapbox about the nutrient density of dairy. So she's also worried about where she sort of understands that dairy is not the best sort of source of calcium, but she's also mentions being worried about magnesium and vitamin D.
Go, Stacey.
Well, okay. I don't know that I'm going to soapbox. I think it's a legitimate concern and question that parents have just because we've been socially brainwashed into thinking that dairy is the only, not even just the best, but like the only place where you can apparently find these nutrients that have been added to milk. And like, it's not very clear to anyone that when you're getting vitamin D in milk, it's been added. Like, it's basically like taking a supplement pill. So there are a lot of things that I know all three of us do with our children. We give them whole food supplements in the form of gelatin smoothies. Someone frequently asks me about probiotics with children, which I think is also really beneficial to children with digestive problems or ASD or
like my yogurt.
Right. And you can also do probiotics either through the yogurt that Kelly's mentioning, or you can ferment things yourself, or you can buy kombucha. My children love Mystic Mango Kombucha by GT's, mm-hmm. which is pretty much available anywhere. We also really love Bubby's sauerkraut and pickles. We try to serve those like at least once or twice a week on the table. We buy like a locally fermented ketchup, which would be more difficult for people to find, but a lot of co-ops and farms sell those. Of course, you can get the book fermented and do that yourself. But I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunities to fill the nutrient voids in foods with whole foods, and they're also more easily digestible. So as much as, you know, we've gotten on major soapbox rants before, and we can link to we have multiple dairy episodes, I think, and Monica can put those in the show notes, that the thing is much more about, you know, thinking through the same process that you would think about from an adult perspective. I think that's what's been really unique for me over the past couple of years is specifically it started with breastfeeding, right? Like when my children were no longer being breastfed 100% of the time, it was like, okay, well, what's the best way to replace the nutrients that they've been getting? And I think for a lot of people, it's like, what's the best substitute food for the thing they've been getting, and they want it to look and feel the same. And so as much as like, if you're at a place in your life where you want to replace milk with something that looks and feels the same, especially if you have a child with sensory processing disorder or ASD and they want something milk-like, obviously do that. But at the same time, you can get more nutrients from other foods that don't look or taste like milk. And it's really easy to grind up some liver and put it in meatballs. And that's a really powerful superfood. It's nutrient dense and it has all of the nutrients that you would get in milk plus like 100 times more. So that's just how we approach feeding our family. We have been dairy free in my family since Cole was essentially like breastfed at 4 weeks, when I realized that he was lactose sensitive. Turns out I have a casein and lactose intolerance and was passing it through my breast milk. And we all have different various stages of what we tolerate in terms of dairy, but I would definitely say that we stick to mainly being a dairy-free family, even after we've done a lot of healing. And even before we were paleo, we were living that lifestyle. So what I would equate it to is that, okay, now this breast milk thing went away and it was a superfood with all these nutrients. Like, what's the best thing that I can do to replace that? And that was like avocado, banana, liver. There were foods that my kids liked texture-wise and taste-wise and that had similar nutrient profiles that I felt good about feeding them. High fat is good for their brain, for their development, and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's the same with older kids. Like, if you're going to take a food away, instead of thinking what's the thing that most looks like and resembles it, think, well, what can I replace it with that has a really good profile for that? You know, like adding greens for calcium. Even almonds are high in calcium. There are a lot of really healthy foods that are real foods that offer the same nutrient density.
And seafood has all of the same nutrients that we're used to getting from milk, plus way more, and including the long chain omega-3 fats, DHA and EPA that I already talked about, that are so vital for brain health.
Yeah. And I find that my children actually really like seafood in a way that adults often don't. And I think that's because, like, they still are drawn to the foods that nourish and heal their bodies. It's always interesting to me what they end up being drawn to. And Matt made a joke, I think with you, Sarah, when you were here the other day, that we offered him like beef, chicken, pork, or fish. Like, and it was like bacon and sausage for breakfast or fish for breakfast. It was something crazy, like leftover tuna fish salad in the fridge. And he was like, fish, 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 fish. He was crazy for it. It's not to say all kids are like that, but Cole went through that too. I remember like when he was much younger, salmon salad and tuna salad were like his favorite preferred food. So there's definitely ways to get seafood in.
Oh, my youngest is so into canned salmon with the bones, and we call it salmon with the bones.
Cat food.
I also am quite fond of salmon with the bones. But that's like her stereotypical lunch, and it's just like the salmon and a fork. Let's squeak in one more question because I think this one's really interesting. It's a question from Jennifer from Buda, Texas. I think I'm pronouncing that right. So she wrote, it is common for ASD kiddos to suffer from yeast overgrowth. Do you feel that paleo addresses the yeast problems that so many ASD kids suffer from? And if so, how? Kelly, you want first stab?
Well, it's not quite fair because we tackled Ashley's yeast when we were grain-free, but not paleo. And for Ashley, I actually did a supplement called Biocidin, which is really similar to like essential oils or homeopathics. It's like garlic and herbs, and it's very concentrated. And I could actually see it coming out in diapers. It was like huge white balls and stuff coming out in her stool. So I don't know. I mean, that's really how we tackled it.
So the answer is yes, that you did experience that.
Oh, yes. Yes. I thought the question was if we had solved it with the diet. We were on the diet more, you know, mostly at the time. But yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah. So the other part of the question of whether or not paleo is good for yeast overgrowth is, you know, the answer is yes, it is very good. And the reason why is because, it is a diet that naturally supports a good balance and variety of bacteria living in the gut. Some people need to go the extra mile of doing something like paleo plus GAPS intro for a couple of weeks to, you know, really handle severe overgrowth. Some people combine paleo with either botanical antimicrobials or non-absorbable antibiotics, and then really focus on the gut healing foods afterwards and lots of probiotics. You know, I've mentioned before on the show that the two diet factors with the most corrective influence on the type of bacteria that are living in your gut is high intake of long chain omega-3 fatty acids from seafood and large amount of vegetables, especially non-starchy vegetables, but also some starchy. And I think, you know, that's kind of already built into a paleo diet, especially a nutrient dense paleo diet, where people are starting to think about how important it is to be incorporating these superfoods like seafood and organ meat and lots of vegetables.
I will say that Ashley has been able to maintain being candida free ever since going paleo. Mm-hmm. We have had her tested because we battled it for years and years and years. And, we've tested it since being paleo, and she's completely yeast free. She's her pH is perfect. It's all across the board good. She's good to go.
Yeah, I think that's a really common experience for people who are coming to a paleo diet with yeast overgrowth or bacterial overgrowth, that it sometimes takes a little tinkering, whether that's low FODMAPs or low starch, or, you know, maybe just some patience. Or the other one is adding digestive support supplements can be really, really helpful for overgrowths, because one of the things that can be causing an overgrowth is insufficient either stomach acid production or digestive enzyme production in the pancreas. And as soon as you support digestion and you actually start digesting your food, you don't have as much extra food for those organisms. So one, you know, people sometimes need to do that little bit of tinkering initially, but it's, you know, a very common experience that once you kind of get that down, mm-hmm. that as long as you're sticking with a paleo diet, it's, you know, it's done, it's permanent.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's those processed things and all the sugar that feed the yeast and feed the bacteria, the bad guys.
Well, and they really do preferentially like the types of starch and proteins that are only partially degraded in yeah. grains. And I know people that are like, wait a minute, yeast and bacteria don't eat protein. And they actually do. And and not all kinds of protein, but they actually really like the proteins in grains and legumes. And that's one of the reasons why grain-free and legume-free diets are so helpful for overgrowths of all kinds. And it's because it actually really profoundly influences what type of bacteria are where.
I thought it was because the carbs turn to sugar.
Well,
and the sugar feeds the yeast.
Yeah, actually, so yeast, I mean, all of these organisms, so it's often overgrowth is yeast, but often it's also bacteria. And they eat all kinds of things. They're definitely feeding on the longer chain starches in grains. And they're definitely feeding on the very specific types of fiber that are in grains that are not as richly found in vegetables. But they can actually also eat the proteins. And so especially the glycoproteins, so they're proteins that have sugar molecules on them. And so they, and what type of food, like the biggest thing that you can do to change the type of organism that's living in your gut is change the food that you're feeding them and yourself. And that's more important than probiotics or, you know, anything else. And so the type of food, like we actually know that, for example, E. coli really like gluten. If you have gluten in your diet, you have more E. coli. And we actually, E. coli also really like alcohol. So if you have a lot of, not just, you know, like alcoholic beverages, but sugar alcohols. So if you're eating like Splenda, that E. coli really like that. So there's, you know, there's still a lot of those details that haven't been worked out, but we actually understand that the type of food, it's what they eat. And then it's also things like how acidic the environment is, which the type of food you eat will affect that. And also the type of bacteria that are growing and what they're producing will affect that even more. And so, so there's a lot of ways that what you eat can feed overgrowth, but it's really, I mean, it's really that these foods are really difficult for us to digest and really easy for them to digest. And that's, you know, the nuts and bolts of why grains and legumes are such problems from a gut health perspective. And it's also interestingly enough why there's this beginning conversation in the paleo movement about adding some traditionally prepared legumes back in. And it's because of the resistant starch in them and how that is such a good food for bacteria. And there's this starting to be this discussion on whether or not that's a good way to support bacteria growth or if it's overfeeding and where that cutoff is and where that balance is. And that's an interesting discussion. I don't think there's a lot of science yet to support either side of the argument. But that is sort of where that whole interesting conversation is coming from in the paleo community.
Cool. Well, as we mentioned earlier, I didn't make very good choices this weekend. And I think I should probably call it a night. But Kelly, we can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your story. I know that it is going to inspire and help so many people that have asked us so many questions. So thank you for coming on and sharing your time and your story with us. And
thank you so much.
Don't forget to check out Kelly's blog, thespunkycoconut.com. It has a ton of recipes, and I can tell you that they're good because I've eaten a ton of them, both from, you know, before we were blogging ourselves to testing and using a lot of her recipes in, like, my favorites, the ice cream book and the chocolate lover's cookbook. And, you're not doing podcasts anymore, right? But you could check out the podcast that I did do with Kelly like over a year ago. I was on her podcast. So can check that
out. I think it was right after the ice cream book came out because I remember we talked about your book and my book.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much. I had a great time. It was really fun.
We are fun.
Sometimes
when we're not too or maybe when we're extra grumpy. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kelly. I just a really interesting discussion. I think it's something that's going to be really, really helpful for a lot of our listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you again next week. Who knows who will be on the show? It's the guest stars just keep on a coming. So check back next week, and if nothing else, Sarah and I will be endlessly entertaining as usual.
I didn't mean to laugh about that.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. I'm funny. It's all right. I did want to thank everyone for leaving Amazon reviews because I went on there. I mean, Amazon reviews, iTunes reviews. Yeah. I mean, you can leave Amazon reviews for our books as well. We'll all love that. but I went on and saw the iTunes reviews for like the first time in months the other day because I had like 5 seconds where I wasn't doing something else. And I was like, oh my gosh, there are so many iTunes reviews. And that's because all of you are awesome. So thank you so much for leaving your reviews and letting people know that you like the show because it helps other people find the show. And Sarah and I's podcast downloads have been growing pretty regularly since we started this podcast a while ago. And Matt gave me this lecture not too long ago about how, do you understand how like successful your podcast is? Like, I listen to crazy, like famous people podcasts and they get less downloads than yours. So to all of you who are contributing to that and tuning in, thank you so much. And thank you for helping other people find the podcast. We can only hope to reach and inspire people, and we can do that through your help and support. So if you've left a review already, thank you so much. And if you haven't, maybe you can consider doing so. It's pretty easy on your iPhone app, or you can do so directly through iTunes as well. We've got instructions, I think, on each of our blogs, but Monica can put it in the show notes if you need a reminder. So thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Why don't we start our questions and answers with a question for you, Kelly? Why don't you tell us about your personal experience with an ASD kid? Like, we could do that.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, yeah. Matt, can you cut that into... You said that really well. No, Matt, I'll say it again. It's fine. And now would be the time to say something really silly for bloopers. Say something silly. I have a 4-year-old girl who would also find that very funny. And a 7-year-old girl who would think that you were just being incredibly rude and it would be like shaming, like huge controversy that you would say such rude things.
They're not allowed to say it. So it is like a big deal when mommy says potty words and they'll say to me, you said a potty word. And I'm like, well, I'm a grown up. Such a mild mannered woman.
Absolutely.
I mean, people who describe me are like, oh, she's so mild mannered.
She's so quiet and polite, and she never swears.
She never expresses her opinion.
No.